Today at the City Club of Chicago, a discussion on the Supreme Court in the wake of the recent death of Justice Antonin Scalia.
Good to be home. Thanks for having me. Hello, everybody. So what we're going to do is we're going to have a wild conversation with two esteemed constitutional law experts. So if Todd and Jeff could come up. The main thing you should know about them is that they are University of Chicago law professors. One is kind of to the left, and one is kind of to the right. I'm going to let you figure out. Anyway, okay, and one of the things is, let's see if you could figure out, in the course of this session, who is who, because who knows what they'll say. But to follow up on what Jay said about how Betty Lou discovered Barack Obama, we could go further back, because the man who hired him at the University of Chicago was Jeff Stone. So if we go into the story of the making of the president, Jeff plays a critical role in it. Now, they all look, can we just stipulate, gentlemen, you're distinguished, you're learned, and accomplished?
At least one of us is.
So you see, everything's going to be a dispute today. Thanks a lot, Todd. So we're talking today as we're in unprecedented political, legal, public affair waters with the replacement battle over the late Judge Scalia. As you know, just to make this short, within hours of his death on February 13th, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said, don't bother, he said to President Obama, don't even bother sending up a name. So the context was set immediately that whoever the president would nominate, and that was never in question, the battle wasn't going to be about the nominee. And that, more than 100 days later, is how things unfolded. So Jeff wrote, I think it was posted today because he's so learned. He writes all the time, right? So he wrote, it's citing someone's study, Jeff, that there's 103 instances that mirror the current state of affairs where presidents were able to appoint nominees and they got hearings and votes. Of course, you all know the hangup now is that Merrick Garland, a proud graduate of Niles West, born in Chicago, I was there on Sunday covering his graduation. Raised in Lincolnwood, who still has a sister who lives in Northbrook and a mother who lives in Lincolnwood. Anyway, so Jeff, so what that there's 103 instances that mirror the current situation? Jeff, why does that matter in this current debate over the Merrick Garland appointment?
So a central question in this is whether the Senate Republicans are acting in a way that is consistent with their obligation to preserve and protect the Constitution, the meaning of the Constitution, the meaning of the advising consent provision, obviously, as with law generally, it can evolve over time. And based upon experience, that guides how we tend to understand the meaning of constitutional obligations. As Lynn said, there have been 103 situations prior to this one in the history of the United States in which an elected president nominated an individual to fill a vacancy on the Supreme Court of the United States prior to the election of the next president in every single one of those instances. Every single one of them. That president was able to appoint the new justice. If the Senate Republicans follow through on what they have promised to do, it will be the first time in 225 years of American history in which an elected president was blocked from the authority to appoint a justice to fill a vacancy that arose before the election of the president's successor. And that's simply extraordinary.
So Todd, does this precedent mean anything in this argument to you?
Well, obviously, precedent matters. I'll say that I don't think Garland should be confirmed to the court. I don't think the Senate Republicans should give him a hearing. So Jeff and I disagree on that front. Let me say why I think his argument goes astray. The first thing is the place to start with interpreting the Constitution is the text of the document. That's where we start. That's not necessarily where we finish. That's where we start. Nothing in the Constitution says that the Senate has to give him a vote, hold hearings, or confirm him. There's no shall in that provision. The only shall is to the president. With respect to holding hearings and whether they have holding hearings, again, the Constitution specifically gives that power for the Senate to set its own rules. If the Senate doesn't want to have hearings, it doesn't have to have hearings. If it doesn't want to have a vote, it doesn't have to have a vote. So in the text of the document, there's nothing that requires the Senate to act. With respect to the precedents, Jeff's right, the Constitution can evolve over time. My fellow travelers on the right, some of them don't believe that to be true, but I'm okay with the Constitution changing to meet the needs of our current environment. I think where he stops short, though, is to say why the Constitution should be frozen at a particular time, say when Justice Kennedy was appointed during a election year. The Constitution evolves in his own way and say, well, this is an escalation by the Republicans, to be sure, but it's an escalation that's followed an escalation that's followed an escalation that's followed an escalation. This is a further escalation. The Democrats have and Republicans have both filibustered judges. They've not held hearings on judges. The courts in general and the Supreme Court particularly have gotten increasingly political. This should not surprise us. As the court takes on more of a political role in our country and decides more political issues, the court will become more politicized. And that political role for the court has increased, and so the politics has increased. And the last thing I'll just say is, if the Senate Republicans don't hold hearings and don't confirm Garland, and the American people don't like it, which the polls suggest they don't, then vote the bums out of office. Hold them politically accountable for their actions. Elect Hillary Clinton, whoever people want to be the president, and that president will be able to confirm the justice they want. This is a political act about a political body, the Supreme Court, and political acts have political consequences. So this isn't really like a law thing. It's just a politics thing.
So, Jeff, Todd has mounted an argument that has credibility in Washington based on how things are panning out, that this is just... why are the Republicans blocking the Garland nomination? Because they can. Is there any legal recourse that the Democrats could take to besides making these presidential arguments?
There's no legal action that the Democrats can take, because if you brought a lawsuit, for example, challenging the constitutionality of the Senate Republicans' behavior, which I believe is unconstitutional, the courts would refuse to address the question on the ground that it's a so-called political question. And the courts are always very reluctant to intervene in disputes between the executive and the legislature about the power of either. So I have no doubt that the court would not address the question.
So could you pinpoint the where is it unconstitutional?
So unlike Todd, I don't think this is an ambiguous question. I don't think it's ever been thought to be an ambiguous question. If you were an originalist, which I'm not particularly, but if you were an originalist and you went back and asked what the framers understood, it's actually quite clear. The framers themselves were a little nervous about giving the president the authority to appoint Supreme Court justices because they were uneasy about abuse of executive authority. And so then they thought about the possibility of giving the Senate the authority to appoint Supreme Court justices. And they decided that would be crazy, because to have a multi-member body like that pick a nominee just wasn't going to work. So what they eventually came up with was the advising consent device. And what their idea was is they wanted the Senate to be able to serve as a check on presidential abuse. And the idea was they could refuse to consent, if there was a legitimate basis for concluding that a nominee was unqualified, was unethical, or was clearly outside the mainstream of acceptable legal thought. And that's what they understood this provision to mean. They did not intend it to mean that if the Senate is in control of the other party, it can do whatever it damn well pleases.
So that would
create paralysis of exactly the sort. And once this happens, what's going to happen in the future is we will blow up the entire process, a process that effectively has actually worked reasonably well throughout 225 years of history.
Why don't you hold the future and what is going to happen? Because I have a whole bunch of questions for you guys on that. But, Todd, is there a constitutional issue that you could see here at all?
Well, I should correct one thing about what you said at the beginning, which is I'm not a constitutional law expert. That's Jeff's domain. So he chose me to be these foil here, and I think he may have chosen me for that reason. But
so actually,
I'll ask you question him on that. But right. But
can I tell you? I chose Todd because no respected conservative constitutional expert was willing to take this position.
Touche.
Hold on. I actually thought that you were put on the program because I saw the video of you doing improv.
Also true. Check it out, the Revival comedy show. Okay. Let me respond to the constitutional claim. So first of all, I share with Jeff, and I admire Jeff. He's in the absolute paragon of law professors in my book. I, like Jeff, am not an originalist. And I frankly don't care what James Madison was thinking at the time that he wrote the Constitution or what the framers thought. It doesn't move me. I think we should interpret the document as it fits us, not as it was frozen in time in 1789. The idea that we should look back to what they thought, if you'd asked James Madison whether or not there was a right to gay marriage enshrined in the Constitution, he would have laughed. So this idea that like is going to decide things for us today, I think is a fanciful and silly one. We should just put it aside. But on the terms of the document, reading it as a lawyer, if we care what the framers put in the document, they knew how to require action by the Senate. There is a presentment clause or various bodies. So the president and the Senate have to cooperate, or the president and the Congress cooperate a lot in the constitutional document and in our constitutional structure. The president signs treaties, and the Senate confirms them. The House and Senate pass laws, and the president gets to vote for a veto. There's all kinds of cooperation baked into the constitutional document. None of them have ever been interpreted to require action by either party. If the president signs a treaty and the Senate never holds hearings like it did on Kyoto, the treaty is not passed. The treaty has not become law. And there's nothing about, oh, well, what the framers, the gridlock. It's not the way the document is interpreted. One place in the Constitution does it require action, and that's in the presentment clause, which is in Article 1, Section 5. If the House and Senate pass a law, a bill, and it goes to the president's desk, and he or she doesn't sign it within 10 days or veto it, it becomes law. That's the only place in the document where there's kind of mandatory move. So I'm not moved on the constitutional text that the Senate must act to confirm the president. I do share with Jeff the concern that this escalation has this tit-for-tat, which the Republicans and Democrats have played about the court, it started with Bork. It has gotten worse and worse and worse over time. And we could point fingers and say, you started it or you started it. I don't think that's very helpful. Neither party has got 100% of the moral high ground here. We could talk about solutions for solving this problem, which Jeff, I think, rightfully has identified. I'm happy to do that, but I'll leave that to
later. We'll get to it.
Yeah.
So what's interesting here, so we just heard Jeff talk about how there is precedent, and Todd talked about so what. Now, if you, which in a way is enough, if you're a Republican, you would say, I don't want a vote, so we're not having one. But what's interesting is that Senate Leader Mitch McConnell, who you're hearing more about in the last few days because he has a new book out, so if you wonder why we're hearing so much about him, he's on book tour. So he said to so what's interesting now is that is the Democrats are trying to, and this is with inside groups, inside the White House and the outside groups, which is a vast coalition of the usual suspects of Democratic groups who are concerned about this. So now it's getting a little personal about Garland himself, even though we all know it's not about Garland. So McConnell said just the other day on MSNBC, from a conservative point of view, I don't think you could pick a worse nominee than Merrick Garland. There is nothing about him that's moderate. Now, there's so much packed into that quote about Garland, assumptions. So my question is, from what you know, and if either of you, do either of you personally know him? You know him? Okay.
I do, yeah.
So as Garland gets, who is in limbo right now, but gets caught up in the crossfire, Tom, let me do this to you. If already I adopt your argument that they're not, you know, it's like what part of what Todd said didn't we hear? They don't have to have a hearing and they don't have to have a vote. So what do you think of McConnell now attacking Garland, saying that he's a worse nominee. You can't pick a worse one, and there's nothing about him that's moderate. What kind of reaction do you have to that?
Well, my first reaction is I'm joined here with my lovely wife who came to watch, and she said that when she heard Garland on his book tour on NPR driving she was driving her car on Lakeshore Drive, and she was so incensed by him that she missed her exit off Lakeshore Drive. So I should say that I go to, just for familial harmony, I should couch all my comments in that vein. Look. The White House and the Democrats have launched a PR campaign for Garland. In fact, the president gave an interview a couple weeks ago with a reporter, and he said, there's a condition for me giving you an interview, and that's you've got to ask me about Garland. So he came to the law school and gave a fantastic presentation about Garland. There has been a media blitz about Garland and making this about Garland. McConnell was smart, I think, to come out right after Scalia died. To make it clear this wasn't going to be about the nominee, to depersonalize it, to claim there's some kind of principle here. I don't think Garland's a good nominee. McConnell's clearly wrong that they couldn't do worse. They could have nominated Jeff. That would have been way worse.
I had to go back.
It's a compliment.
No, Garland, they could have done a lot worse. My objection to Garland on the merits, if you want to talk about the merits, is Garland believes the government should win. That's basically his bottom line. He's never ruled against a labor union in an NLRB case. He always rules for the government, even in close cases. I know Jeff will say, that's the way the administrative structure of the government is built. The agencies of the federal government get deference and so forth. But even in close cases where there have been divided courts, he always, almost always, 90% of the time, is in favor of the government. And this is, it cuts ideologically. He ruled against Guantanamo prisoners having habeas corpus rights, a case, an opinion that was overruled by the Supreme Court in a case called Rasul versus Bush. So he generally comes down on the side of the government. He's a big government guy. I'm not. I don't believe in the government having a big sway in the economy. I don't believe the government should have a big sway in our bedrooms, in our social life. I think the government should be smaller. So I don't like him for that reason. Is he qualified? Is he smart? Absolutely. But the court has become something more than just, are you qualified? That's not just the only standard anymore. Ideology and what kind of conception you have about America is really important because the Supreme Court decides increasingly what kind of America we live in.
And hold that thought, because I will get to the partisanship on it. So, Jeff, what do you make of this personal attack on Garland as he's the worst, and the quote that I read you from McConnell?
He's apparently trying to sell books. It's an idiotic statement, frankly. I've known Garland a long time. He was a law clerk to Justice William Brennan several years after I was, and there were reunions among law clerks for many years, and so I got to know Merrick fairly well during that time. He's very much exactly what he appears to be. He is a very modest person. He's a very thoughtful person, very decent, good person. And what Todd describes as for the government, ironically, it just means he basically believes in judicial restraint. I mean, he is essentially someone who embodies the kind of value as Richard Nixon celebrated. That is, he's not a judicial activist. He is a traditional, from that standpoint, conservative. Now, his values are more liberal than that. They are. But his basic judicial philosophy is traditional judicial restraint conservative. And that doesn't mean he wouldn't strike down anything, but it does mean that relative to the normal distribution of judges, he's very much on the judicial restraint side of the line. It's hard to imagine any credible nominee from a Democratic president who would be more acceptable to Senate Republicans than someone like Merrick Garland. Not only is he extremely moderate and cautious, but he's also 63 years old, which makes him the oldest nominee in almost half a century. Presidents want, for obvious reasons, nominees who are in their 40s or early 50s.
Jeff, you make it sound as if the White House consulted an actuary before the appointment.
Oh, the White House clearly decided to nominate the person who was most plausibly acceptable to the Republicans in the hope that they could find a common ground.
So let me jump ahead, because this is a question you might think I would ask last, but I want to get it in here just so we do it justice. Your guess, your projection, can Garland get, if there is a path, which is very narrow now, for a confirmation, tell me the scenario, if you believe there is any scenario, Todd and then Jeff, and what would it be? By that I mean, it's lame duck and President Trump is elected and the Republicans hold the Senate, or Hillary's elected and the Republicans hold the elected, or the Democrats get the Senate and Trump is elected.
So I think what could happen, my spies on Capitol Hill tell me that if Secretary Clinton is elected and there's no justice seated by the time she takes office, that the Republicans would pretty much confirm whoever she puts up. I think they'll have a long, drawn-out fight to try to distract her in her first 100 days in office, but I think they would eventually seat even someone to the left of Garland. So I don't get the sense that, you know, we're going to have eight forever, although maybe, and I'm happy to come back to this. I'm not sure that's the end of the world, but we'll come back to that. So let me just say how I think Garland is going to get on the court, because I think he will eventually. I think that between now and the election, it will become clear that the Democrat is going to win. And at some point before the election, the Republicans will have a kind of emergency vote on the floor that will be a voice vote. They'll just say, you know, Mr. President, I rise, President of the Senate, I rise to, you know, confirm Merrick Garland, and they'll confirm him before the president can withdraw the nomination. Because you might think the president, if Hillary's going to win, would withdraw the nomination to let her put somebody younger and more liberal. And the Republicans obviously don't want that. So then I think the interesting thing will be whether the Democrats would filibuster at that point. So it's 3 days before the election. Hillary's ahead by 20 points in the polls. The Republicans do a surprise vote and say, we're going to vote right now. And then the Democrats are forced to know, like, should we filibuster this?
So, Todd, interesting prediction. Let's remember it. He predicts the path that Garland gets on the court. Jeff, what is your analysis and prediction, and how does it work? Then I might tell you mine.
I agree that if Clinton is elected, or if it's so completely obvious that she will be elected, that the Republicans will rush to confirm Merrick Garland, because he is the best-case scenario from their perspective. I actually believe that if it gets to that point, that Obama and Clinton and Garland should have Garland withdraw. And to basically say, look, we're willing to put this up, but you structured this as a heads I win, tails you lose situation. In my view, in a way that was completely incompatible with American values and history and traditions, and we can't let you play that game successfully. And therefore, if it's clear that Clinton's going to win and the Democrats will control the Senate, that second thing is critical too, then I think what they should do is to withdraw Garland, probably make him Attorney General, and appoint a 32-year-old William Douglas to the Supreme Court.
So let me say one thing about Jeff accused the Republicans as being un-American and inconsistent with history. One example from history, and I'm not a historian nor am I a constitutional historian, but one example from history in the Supreme Court nominations that people forget about is one of the worst presidents of all time, Herbert Hoover, in an election year with a hostile Senate, nominated a Democrat, Judge Cardozo, to be on the Supreme Court. And that was an act of political awareness. He knew it was an election year. He knew he was going to lose to Franklin Roosevelt. He had a hostile Senate, and he nominated someone from the other party. And if Obama had nominated Frank Easterbrook from the Seventh Circuit, you said we couldn't have done it worse. I would have been completely happy with that result. If he nominated a Republican judge, even a more moderate judge than Judge Easterbrook, again, we wouldn't be having this conversation. And there is historical precedent for that. So I just wanted to highlight the Cardozo example, which I think people forget about.
And for my my view is nothing happens until the lame duck. Whatever a scenario is, I think what will happen is that the endangered Senate candidates in New Hampshire, Kelly Ayotte, Richard Burr in North Carolina, Mark Kirk here already has staked his turf by doing it early. He was clear and has kind of stayed out of the crossfire of the outside groups, which are just pounding on Grassley and Burr and Kelly Ayotte on the Merrick Garland issue. But I think nothing happens until lame duck, for my two cents. But now I want to go to this whole idea of this perception that it's really just four Democratic judges against four Republican judges in this 8-8. Now, there have been 11 decisions in May. About a quarter of them, I think, have been reflecting this 4-4 splits. I have read, since, as you know, I'm no Supreme Court scholar, that this means that the results of all this legal maneuvering is that there's really almost none to small results legally by the Supreme Court. What's wrong with that? Why can't? What's wrong with the 8-8? And let me just say this as you answer. Keep this in mind. Ruth Bader Ginsburg has said in an interview, 8, quote, is not a good number.
Well, the simple answer is the Supreme Court, like all courts, have odd numbers because they don't want endless splits. That's paralysis. And so no one has ever created a court in the United States, in the history of the United States that I know of, with an even number of judges for obvious, practical, sensible reasons. Let me say a word about why this is happening. Right? The real reason this is happening is because the court is in a historic moment. And that is, the court's basically been divided before Justice Scalia's untimely death, 5-4, across a range of extremely controversial issues, with the five conservatives in the majority on affirmative action, on campaign finance reform, on abortion, and on voting rights for minorities, and on all those issues, with Scalia gone and a Garland replacing him, guns or another one, the balance of the court on those issues shifts. And the stakes are therefore extremely high. And it's easy to see why the Republicans are in a panic about this. And that's what this is all about. It has nothing to do with principle. It has nothing to do with constitutional interpretation. It has to do with, we don't want that world to exist, and we're going to do everything we can to stop it. And the problem is that is not legitimate. In the last 40 years, there have been 9 confirmations in which the justices significantly changed the ideological makeup of the court. In 8 of those, the confirmed justice moved the court significantly to the right. And they were confirmed anyway. The only exception with Ruth Ginsburg, as Todd pointed out to me not long ago, was Ruth Ginsburg replacing Byron White. But other than that, whether it's Warren Burger replacing Earl Warren, or David Souter replacing William Brennan, or Clarence Thomas replacing Thurgood Marshall, or John Paul Stevens replacing William Douglas, Samuel Alito replacing Sandra Day O'Connor, every one of those, with that one exception, moved the court to the right. This is basically a moment where it could move to the left, and the Republicans will not allow it to happen, and that's what this is about.
But if you're a Republican, why is that? I mean, if you're, you know, the court doesn't exist, these appointments don't exist in a vacuum. In a way, I wonder what is happening now is just basic politics. If you, why take action now? Because you may have President Trump, and he's already put out his 11 picks. Why would you, even if it's not personal with President Obama, just not play it out with the only thing to think about that if Trump wins and you're a Democratic senator, then like heck, you're going to ever move on any of his appointments.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to speak for Jeff because
oh, go ahead,
unlike Bob. No.
And whoever has the questions, if they can bring up the questions too so I could start looking at them, yeah, whoever has them.
Unlike the people in Washington, Jeff has an incredible amount of integrity and principle. So I don't know what he would have said if the shoe was on the other foot.
I have no doubt in this case what I would have said.
I believe you. But I'm 100% sure if the shoe was on the other foot, the Democrats in control of the Senate, a Republican president, the switch from left to right, the same arguments would be being made. So the idea that there are deep principles here and one side is the moral high ground is just demonstrably false. Joe Biden gave a speech on the floor of the Senate talking about how we shouldn't have nominations in election years. And there's other examples. I just think the room should not believe that this is a completely one-sided thing. The cases that Jeff suggested are the big ones. I don't have ideological commitments that are consistent across those cases. Some of the times I think the five Republicans are right. On some of those things, I think they're wrong. So I'm not saying that, you know, I'm not lining up my ideological preference. I'm with Lynn. I think, you know, what she said, which is this is just politics. And the court is now more political than ever before. I would have preferred, I'm in favor of gay marriage. I would have preferred us to win those battles in state legislatures, in the court of public opinion, maybe with a federal law, moving us towards that, we the people deciding together that we should respect the unions of our gay and lesbian fellow citizens. The fact that that emanated from the Supreme Court, nine lawyers who happen to know politicians, that distresses me as a citizen. So the people that have made the culture war issues end, one Southeast in Washington at the Supreme Court, they've brought us to this point where the court has become overly political. So I have a solution for depoliticizing it, and I'll let you ask me about that later.
Okay, because let me ask the question, since we have an answer in search of a question. So now I actually had the question. This is from Bobby Zabel. Bobby? There you are. Okay. Mr. Henderson labels the court a political institution. I thought the purpose was to be above politics and issue decisions on the legal merits of the case, not political agendas. So if you could incorporate what you were going to with this question, please.
Yeah, look, on most cases, interpreting ERISA, IRS, all these things, the court is basically not political. And somebody like Justice Kagan, I have an enormous amount of respect for. Justice Breyer, they're good technical lawyers. They make good arguments. And the cases are not political in that sense. So I think the court is filled with lots of good lawyers, and they make decisions based on law, based on precedent, based on the kind of interpretive canons that we lawyers are familiar with. In cases like affirmative action, campaign finance, the culture war issues, the court is acting like a super legislature. And no one can deny that. No one with a straight face can deny that. Now, my solution for depoliticizing the nomination and confirmation process is the way to make these things less contentious is to have more of them. It's kind of counterintuitive. But if you gave terms to the justices, let's say a justice would serve for an 18-year term, that would, first of all, make sure we don't have a bunch of octogenarians on the court, which I think is a real problem. My dad's 76 years old now. I'm not sure I want him being a Supreme Court justice into his 80s. So I think having octogenarians on the court, probably not a good idea, especially considering if you're in the political party that is the opposite of the president and you're 86 years old and you know your mind is failing, you have incentives to stay on. So I think we should have term limits for the Supreme Court justices. And if you have them be 18-year terms, every president knows they're going to be nominating justices with some regularity. So the idea of, I'm going to really make this a 5-4, well, the president's going to have another one during their term. The process will become much more regular. We'll get a lot more turnover, and these things will become just a regular course of business.
So Gabe Roth, where are you? Okay, so Gabe asked the question that you just gave the answer to, but I want to give you your props for the question. So here's the – Todd is so good.
That's
this
right.
Is how good that he knew that I was about to ask him a question. This is where we really get to the very advanced culture of the City Club that the panelist knows ahead of time because we've just got a thing. So here's the question that you just answered. Do you think that fixed terms for the justices as opposed to life tenure will solve the problems created by unpredictable vacancies?
I do.
Right. So now we know this is how we're going to run these things. We're very efficient here, right, Todd? Thank you. So what do you think of term limits, Jeff?
I think basically it's a good idea. I think that octogenarian justices is not a great way of running the government, and I don't think we should have octogenarian elected officials either, for that matter. So even though I don't want to be accused of age discrimination, but I think there are advantages to that. I think there are advantages to term limits, not just because of age, also because of the the organized and regularized. Right.
Because actually, if you have a term limit, doesn't have to be ageism, because you could nominate a 70-year-old to an 18-year-old term. I mean.
Right. Could I say a word, though, about the politicization of the court in response to what Todd said earlier? Because I think it's both true and not true. I think you have to ask yourself, if you want to understand the appropriate role of the Supreme Court of the United States and of the federal judiciary, is when are they supposed to invalidate the actions of the democratically elected branches of government? Right? And I believe the right answer to that question is that they are primary, and the framers of the Constitution were very aware of this, that the primary thing they were concerned about and the primary reason they relied upon judicial review was they understood that democracy could be dysfunctional as well as effective. And they were particularly concerned about democracy being dysfunctional in the sense of majorities being hostile to and insensitive to the interests and needs of historically oppressed and disadvantaged and subordinated groups. And that's the single most important justification for judicial review. And that, therefore, I think the court is most certainly operating in an appropriate manner when it invalidates laws that discriminate against African Americans or Hispanics or women or people who are accused of crime or gays and lesbians, and not so much when it strikes down laws that deal with guns or with restricting how much money rich people can spend. And not when it strikes down laws protecting voting rights. So I think the politicization is very much on the right to these days, much more than the left.
Can I just say a quick response to that? Very quick.
Hold your thought. Yeah. This is like a point of information. Remember, Congress can change. It is not – you don't need a – it just could be a vote of Congress, right, Jeff, to change? Because the Supreme Court at one time was 8 members.
It's been 6 and –
Right.
So let me just say one thing to that and then a quick thing about the 8 members. So Jeff and I are aligned here in saying I admire the court when it acts in a counter-majoritarian way, when it sticks up for people who are in the categories that he described as people who are systematic losers in the political process. So we're in alignment on that. I think the judicial activism for you and not for me, however, for me and not for you, I think is a little bit hard to swallow. So I would like to see the next president, Gary Johnson, maybe, hopefully. I'd like to see him appoint activist judges who are going to take economic liberties and economic rights as seriously as the rights that Jeff mentioned, in addition to the rights Jeff mentioned. So when the legislature acts in a way that biases the labor markets against entrepreneurs and in favor of the political classes who donate to them, I'd like to see the court step in and act in the counter-majoritarian way there too. So my activism on judges is just for both of us, not for me and not for you. With respect to the 8 votes, look, the early returns on the court being completely paralyzed and not effective are not ringing true. Justice Breyer was quoted recently as saying he thinks it's working pretty well. In the Little Sisters of the Poor case, where there was this contraceptive mandate, the Supreme Court was deadlocked, but they agreed to send it back for the parties to kind of resolve it. They were sort of acting like a super arbitrator, and I think that's a better result. I think the political branches will actually come to a resolution of that case that's better than if the 5-4 had come out and saying, oh, this violates the Constitution, this part of Obamacare, or not. So I think the sort of compromise-forcing nature of the tie is actually pretty effective. There will be some cases that have to be resolved, and there are some disagreements that are buried in 8-0 opinions that people don't know about, but the Republic is not paralyzed. In fact, the Republic wouldn't be paralyzed, I don't think, if we didn't have a Supreme Court. England doesn't have anything like a constitutional Supreme Court, and I don't see minorities and all these groups being, you know, woefully oppressed in the UK.
So the court does have its lightest, following the death of Justice Scalia, the court does have its lightest caseload in decades. And we're coming to a close, so be a little briefer because I have one or two other questions I want to get in. Do you see any harm coming from this light caseload, Jeff and then Todd?
The number of cases that the Supreme Court decides has gone down by well over 50%. In the last 40 years. And
I don't know that it matters so much because a lot of the cases they're not deciding that they used to decide were not momentous issues. I think to the extent that there are really important, pressing constitutional questions or statutory questions of great consequence, the court's addressing those. So, you know, why it's deciding many fewer cases is a bit of a mystery to almost everybody. But I don't think there's a big problem with that.
Yeah, I don't think so either. I read all the Supreme Court opinions, and most of them would put all of us to complete sleep. There's a few headline grabbers. You know, one of the big holdover cases is whether Indian tribes have civil jurisdiction. Or most people don't care. This is the only City Club event in the next couple weeks that's not sold out, probably because most people really don't care about the Supreme Court. It's not something that really registers in the public imagination. If you go out on the street there on Grand Avenue and take a random stranger and say, name one Supreme Court justice, you're going to be lucky if you get one. You might get one, you might get two. Most people don't even know, and I don't think it's the end of the world. And for the Democrats in the room, which, based on the reactions of people, is everybody, take comfort in knowing that Democratic presidents have appointed a majority of the lower court judges in the United States. So the district courts, the trial court level for the federal courts, and the courts of appeals, those are now majority Democrats, which means if the Supreme Court can't decide things, they get decided by lower courts, which are more likely than not to be a Democrat. So it's not like the end of the world that the Republic hinges on us resolving this. A couple of the cases that Jeff has mentioned, haven't been decided or wouldn't be decided, the affirmative action case. The biggest one for me is Fisher, which was about public sector unions, and this is a bad room to say this, but boy, the Republicans really missed an opportunity with Scalia's death not to put a knife in the back of the public sector unions. That was a big loss. The issues about arbitration and collective these are issues that I care about. The Republicans won't have a chance with a 4-4 tie to do much on these, or if Garland is appointed. But those are pretty much minor issues for most people.
Jeff, any harm?
Harm from?
Well, by having this light caseload.
You
were fine. Okay.
The real issue here, my view, is if you care about affirmative action and gun regulation and abortion and campaign finance and voting rights, the Supreme Court matters enormously. And those issues are all up in the air.
Okay, so this is a question that I think is a little different. A little provocative, I think, deliberately, but it could be answered with a yes or no question if we're getting short on time. Where's Thomas Lee? Where are you? Okay, hi, Tom. It's been a while. Okay, if the president were to leave Judge Garland, were to have Judge Garland sworn in, would it stand up? I.e., just don't have a vote and just swear him in. Guys, what do you think?
It would not be constitutional.
Yeah, terrible idea. Not, definitely not constitutional because, and I'm saying this on the text, it's in the text, needed advice and consent of the Senate. The history that Jeff has mentioned, never happened before. You know, I don't think the other eight justices would look too kindly on it because I think for whatever they think of the politics of this, they would think that was a massive usurpation of presidential authority. Now, do I think the American people would care? Probably not. The American people overwhelmingly want to see Garland on the Supreme Court, according to the polls. And frankly, I think they would just say, well, you know, that all that inside baseball about who gets advice and consent, we don't really care. We just want to get our guy on the court so he can rule in the way Jeff says. I don't think it would be a political crisis. I don't think Secretary Clinton would lose the election if Obama did that. I don't think the justices would want it, and I think everybody who cares about the Constitution should be up in arms about it.
Okay, before I ask my last question, show of hands, who thinks Merrick Garland, one way or the other, will end up being on the Supreme Court? Okay. Last question. Donald Trump put out a list of his judges that he would nominate for the Supreme Court. Is this something that you think candidates should do so the public can share their thinking, and what did you think of the list?
I have no problem with the candidate choosing to do that. It's just information about the candidate, assuming, of course, it's a real list and it has any meaning. But I'm quite confident I've never heard of any of them before. But the truth is, you know, it includes the most obvious, plausible Republican
names if Trump were elected or if some other Republican had been elected. At least some of those people would be on that list, and I don't see any harm in doing it.
So a matter of public policy, it might be something to think about. What do you think, Todd?
Yeah, I mean, I'm no fan of Trump. I thought this was a pretty brilliant political move. I agree with Jeff that he doesn't know any of these people, has never heard of any of these people, wouldn't care. He asked some intern, dig up a name of, you know, 10 conservative judges. I know some of these people and respect them. I am kind of surprised that politicians, and this probably explains why I'm not a politician, don't do this kind of thing more often. These are the people who would be in my cabinet. These are the people who would be, I would put on the court. In part because one thing we forget, and this is a real problem with Trump as a candidate, so if you're listening, Donald, and voters, when we elect a president, we don't just elect a president. We elect a vast group of people who will move into power. When I was a lawyer in Washington, everybody in my office left and went in, worked in the Bush administration when he was elected. There are a bunch of lawyers, Republican lawyers in Washington just waiting for a Republican president so that they can move into positions of power. And most of the people I know in those positions would not do that in a Trump administration, at least the ones who have any integrity. And so that, I think, is a reason he's putting this out, is he's sort of putting a marker and saying, this is what my administration would kind of look like. Not surprising he would do that. I'm surprised politicians don't do that more often, because you're not just electing a president, you're electing a Secretary of State and a Secretary of Defense and so forth.
Interesting. And on that note, Todd and Jeff, thanks for doing this. And Jay, it's all yours.
Sit down for 1 minute. All right, hold on. One more. I don't know if Lynn said this. I had to step out for a minute. But there's one of our panelists who hired a fellow named Barack Obama. Oh, you did. All right. Now, did you ever see your hiree becoming president of the United States?
So there's two answers to that. When I first met Obama, he was a 24-year-old student at Harvard Law School, and I was interviewing him to be a law and government fellow at Chicago. I was dean of the law school at the time. And after a half-hour interview, I told my secretary, he is amazing. He was poised. He was mature. He had self-possessed. And she talked to him for a few minutes before he came in to see me, and she said, he's going to be governor of Illinois someday. And it was all there. It really was all there. But then the other piece of this is several years later, when he announced he was running for the Democratic Senate seat, U.S. Senate seat, after having been defeated by Bobby Rush when he ran for Congress. And you may recall that Senator Fitzgerald was the incumbent, a Republican. He was pretty popular at the time. There were three very well-known statewide Democrats who were already throwing their hat in the ring for the Democratic nomination. And Ab Mikva and I were hosting a fundraiser for the Clinton Foundation downtown, and Obama was working the crowd, and I was watching him go around, shake everybody's hands, look him in the eye, be very sincere, you know. And he and I wind up at the shrimp bowl together. And I said, Barack, I've been watching you, and I got to tell you, this is pathetic. I said, you know this is never going to happen, yeah. Right? I think if you really settle down and focus on it, you could actually cut it as an academic. And he said, thanks, Jeff, I really appreciate that. But I think I have an opportunity and a responsibility, and I have to go for this. And he then turned and went back into the crowd, and I remember sitting there looking at him as he walked away and saying, what a putz.
Yeah. On that note, thank you. Let's give him a round of applause. Thank you. Hold on.